Bangladesh is under fire for relocating Rohingya refugees to a remote island off the coast. Human rights groups say that some are being forced to relocate, and one has even called it an island detention center. We'll speak with the representative from Amnesty International about the growing crisis. But first, as India's farmer protests continue to block major highways into New Delhi, has Prime Minister Narendra Modi gone too far with his agricultural reforms? That is our arena. Since late last month, tens of thousands of Indian farmers have camped along highways outside New Delhi's borders, braving the cold temperatures and the risk of coronavirus to protest controversial agriculture reforms. Prime Minister Narendra Modi says the new laws are necessary to deregulate and modernize India's agriculture sector, which is the primary source of income for 58% of Indians. But farmers say they were not consulted when the reforms were pushed through and worry the changes will make them vulnerable to exploitation from large corporations. So, as the protests enter their fourth week, is there an end in sight to this standoff? To help us answer this, we're joined by Anila Singh, a spokesperson of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, and Yogendra Yadav, the president of the Swaraj India Party and a member of the Jai Kisan Andolan, one of the farmers' organizations leading the protests. Yogendra, I want to start with you. And because of your involvement in the protests, you've actually been at these protest camps near the New Delhi border. There have been six rounds of talks between the government and the farmers. The government has said that they are willing to make seven amendments to the bill, including a written assurance that they will not do away with what's known as the minimum support prices for farmers, the MSP, which is one of their biggest concerns. So why did the farmers reject those amendments? What is it they want?
Sadly, in these talks, there's actually very little talk. Both sides are talking past each other, and the government really doesn't want to listen to the farmers. The government not only wants to decide what it wants to say, but it also seems to wish to decide what the farmers should be saying. Every time government says, we've conceded this demand, we've conceded that demand. And in the evening, farmers' unions say, but we never demanded this. Farmers are saying something very clear. Procedurally, all these acts were brought in without consultation, without acceptance, and by fraudulent parliamentary procedures. They also violate the federal principles of India. Substantively, the real fear of the farmers is that this would dismantle, compromise very seriously the existing agriculture marketing system. And this would put farmers to permanent disadvantage. Farmers feel that this is a signal of the state withdrawal from agriculture and bringing in of big agribusiness. Get big or get lost is the kind of thing that might happen. The government doesn't address any of these things. The government comes up with amendments while farmers are saying that the basic intent of these three laws is perverse. Amending these won't serve. Please take it away. And just one final point I wish to make is that in this entire discussion, we forget that these three laws were meant to be historic gift to the farmers of India. Now, when you gift someone, and that person says, no, thank you, I actually don't want it. And if you really want to give me something, here is what I really want. Where is the scope for bargaining then?
So, Anila, what about what Yogendra's saying? He basically is saying that you all are talking past each other and that specifically the government is not listening.
This is absolutely a wrong accusation, I can say so. We have always taken in consideration of all. That is the mission and vision of our Prime Minister, Narendra Modi ji. Since he has become Prime Minister, he had been working for the people of our country. And he is trying to improve the lifestyle of all the segments living in our country. And he had pledged that he is going to improve the lifestyle of farmers as well when he became Prime Minister. But unfortunately, if I talk about my country, whenever there is a major change, there are so many challenges because ours is a democratic country. And, you know, socialism is so steeped in our system.
So just a moment, if I may, you say that it's a democratic country, but the way these bills were rammed through, that is a problem. So first you bypass the parliament in June, decreed them into law as a temporary measure. Then when the bills finally went to parliament, that was in September, there was no debate about the reforms. The votes were not even properly counted. The bills were passed with this chaotic voice vote, which is basically members of parliament just yelling yes or no based on who can yell the loudest. Is that really the most democratic way to pass such divisive reforms? You keep saying you're a democracy.
No, this is the way. In parliament, yes, the discussion, you know, it happened. And the members of all political parties, they were present there. And by voting and by admittance, yes, this bill should be passed for the sake of farmers. It was clear. But the thing is,
but how was it
if
clear,
we talk about the farmers who are protesting, just allow me, please. And the farmers who are protesting outside Delhi borders, they are from Punjab, majorly from Punjab. And that represents only 0.2% of the farmers living in our country. So if you want to say that the farmers who are sitting right on the borders and sieging Delhi, they are representing each and every farmer living in our country, that is absolutely wrong. And why they are sitting there? Because the dependency of Punjab farmers is so much on APMC, that is why they are there. There is a nexus in between government, APMC, and capitalist farmers. And I don't know why social activists and farmer leaders like Yogesh Yadavji are advocating for them. They are capitalist farmers. Their dependency has to be reduced. And there are many factors, I can tell you so, that why their dependency should be reduced now. This is the high time that Punjab and Haryana, they should move away from this dependency. And the government has taken this step for this sake.
So first of all, I just want to make sure that our viewers know the APMC is the government-run market. Shagendra, she mentioned you. I'd like you to respond.
Number one, India's parliamentary procedures require, it's one of the sacrosanct procedure, that even if one member demands written vote, then voice vote is not allowed. Why did that not happen? On Punjab, may I point out that the place where I'm doing the dharna, I'm involved in that sit-in on the national highway, there's not even 1% of farmers from Punjab. These are farmers from the western state of Rajasthan and from the state of Haryana. And by saying that if farmers need to grow out of APMC's dependence on government marketing system, I suspect Ms. Singh has let the cat out of the bag. That's exactly what the farmers suspect these bills are all about. Yes, they actually read you right, and you have confirmed it. Farmers fear that the existing government marketing system is about to give in. And these proposals have been brought in so that big agribusiness can replace. That is precisely the fear of the farmer.
So, Yogendra, let me ask you this. We've talked about MSP, the minimum support prices that are really sacrosanct for farmers. But what's confusing in reality is very few farmers actually get those prices. Even the highest estimates have it at 15, maybe 25%, right? But most farmers in Punjab, for instance, who are at the heart of these protests, they do benefit from minimum support prices. So are these protests about farmers in a certain part of the country, or are farmers elsewhere invested in this cause right now?
You're absolutely right. The minimum support price that the government of India declares every year mainly remains on paper. About 80% farmers don't benefit, at the most around 20% benefit. Farmers' movements and organizations over the years have been demanding that this formality be turned into a reality. The 20 should become 35, 40, 50, 60. Instead, what the government is saying is the effect of what the government is doing would be to reduce, scale down this 20 into 10, maybe into 5. No wonder those who are current beneficiaries of the system are the first ones to protest. Please remember, everyone else is also joining it, because what the farmers are really saying is this: please don't us this gift that we never wanted. Give us the gift that we want. And what they want is legal guarantee to back minimum support price, remunerative assured price. That's what the farmers want. Turn it into a legal guarantee. Why doesn't the government do it?
Anila?
unfortunately, people like Mr. Yadav, you know, they have pushed back agriculture sector in our country. Almost 60% of workforce is in farm sector, and the participation in GDP is only 15 to 16%. This is the reason. They do not want that people engaged in farming sector, they should get more option. They do not want that new technologies should be introduced in this sector. They don't want that people should go and sell their produce directly to whom they want to. Why? And you are talking about the MSP, full guarantee. Is it possible, Mr. Yadav? Is it possible? You are a well-read person. You know it very well. And you name one country which has got 23 crops under MSP and they are paying full MSP, or you can say the guaranteed MSP price to the farmers. It is very easy to accuse. As I mentioned earlier, that ours is a democratic country and we love to take all sort of inputs which we get. But the thing is, when you have to take tough decisions, you need to have a very strong political willpower. And that is what Mr. Narendra Modi ji have.
We're talking about politics, and the Prime Minister Narendra Modi, he is very popular. But even popular leaders have limits, particularly in a democracy, right? He enacted deeply unpopular economic measures, the goods and services tax, that massive demonetization move that banned 86% of the country's currency, did that overnight. Even with those policies that hurt a lot of poor and marginalized Indians, he won re-election in a landslide this year. But now this overhaul that you're talking about, that you are saying is the best thing for the farmers, this overhaul of the agriculture sector that accounts for the livelihoods of more than half of all Indians, as you've both pointed out, has he gone too far this time by alienating farmers, a very important political constituency?
See, this is what I mentioned earlier, that Mr. Narendra Modi ji is the first prime minister in our country who never bends down under anything. If he has to take a step for the nation, he takes that. He knows this time that he has to improve the life of farmers, so he has taken the steps. Earlier also, we have seen that a whole lot of protests and agitation he had to face for whatever steps he took earlier for our nation, but he never bent down. And this time also, he is saying that this is for the farmers. I am standing with the farmers. I have to give more options to the farmers. I have to create agripreneurs. I want young generation to get involved in agriculture rather leaving it. So this is being understood by major area of the farming sector. And the youngsters, especially, they are understanding it.
So let me put that.
We have to agree
one
thing.
Let me put that to you, Gendra, right? So, Anila, what she's been saying is that these changes that the prime minister wants to make are actually for the good of the farmers, and there's a segment of it, of the farmers that are invested in this not working. They don't want it to work, and the younger generation gets it. Do you agree with that? Where do the farmers stand on this? Are there different groups that feel differently? And what about what she's saying, that they know what's best for you?
That's 19th century paternalism. And I thought in democracies, we had moved away from that. What my friend described, the simple name for that is hubris. Hubris doesn't pay in politics in the long run. It is absolutely clear that demonetization policy done by Mr. Narendra Modi would go down in the textbooks of economics as one of the greatest economic disasters. We are dealing with that kind of a person. And I really, the more I think about it, the more I'm convinced. Mr. Modi is a political genius. I would never deny that. He continues to be popular. I would not deny that. But does he have what it takes to handle a complex and large economy like India? Someone who can take such large decisions decision was taken without consulting a single serious economist in the country. And this agriculture policy decision has been taken without consulting a single farm organizations. Can such a prime minister deal with complexity of the kind? I really think this time, demonetization he got away with, various other decisions he got away with, but this time he's got his match. Farmers have a way in Indian politics of getting back at leaders. who do damage them in a serious way. And I'm afraid that is the kind of fate Mr. Narendra Modi is inviting this time.
And that will be the final word. Yugendra Yadav, Anila Singh, thank you so much for joining me in the arena. Some 1 million Rohingya Muslim refugees now live near Bangladesh's Cox's Bazar as the threat of genocide persists in their home country, Myanmar. With no hope of repatriation in the near future, the Bangladeshi government is looking for new ways to grapple with one of the largest refugee populations in the world, including sending refugees to an island off the coast of Bangladesh. That plan has drawn international outcries. Human rights groups say such a move would deprive refugees of their freedom of movement and subject them to potentially dangerous living conditions. Is Bangladesh still a safe haven for the Rohingya, or is it turning into just another nightmare? Joining me to discuss this from Colombo, Sri Lanka, is Saad Hamadi, South Asia campaigner at Amnesty International. Saad Hamadi, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront. So Bangladesh has been celebrated for taking in so many Rohingya refugees fleeing neighboring Myanmar. But now it's under fire from human rights groups for this attempt to relocate about 100,000 people to this 40-square-kilometer island called Baisinchar. Your organization, Amnesty International, has reported allegations of sexual abuse by those in charge of policing the island. Fortify Rights, a human rights organization that has been investigating crimes against humanity in Myanmar for years, has called this island, Baisinchar, an island detention center. So why is the government continuing to relocate refugees there when plenty of experts have pointed out this is not the right place? There may be better options.
Yes, we have heard accounts of allegations from refugees who are on the island, allegations of sexual harassment and sexual abuse. And we've called on the Bangladeshi government to investigate those allegations. Clearly, these are allegations that we've heard from the refugees. The authorities have not responded or clarified on those allegations when we sought their right of reply. The United Nations has not had the opportunity to go to the island to assess on its own. And same goes for the humanitarian agencies and human rights groups. Our concern is that in a protracted refugee situation, where you have the international community contributing the humanitarian assistance and where the onus is on the international community to support Bangladesh and the Rohingya refugees in a crisis as big as this, it's important that all the actors have their access, have their mandate to carry out the assessments that they need to determine whether the island is habitable, the scientific data that is needed, the feasibility of operating between the mainland and the island, and all those concerns. We don't have those data as of yet. We've called on the Bangladeshi authorities to allow Amnesty International to go to the island and see for themselves what is there, what kind of conditions there are to ensure the freedom of movement between the island and the mainland, what guarantees there are. So we don't know for certain whether this is there.
Okay, so Saad, the Bangladeshi government, they have said that this relocation is necessary in an effort to improve security because of concerns in these camps, which are very cramped. There's been gang-related violence there that's resulted in at least 8 people being killed in October and the displacement of 2,000 families. Does the government have a point that they have to do something?
Yes, we've seen the gang violence happen in October, but that could be a pretext for many reasons. And the violence in the camp, in the refugee camp in Cox's Bazar, cannot justify a relocation to an island. What it calls for is investigation, independent, immediate, impartial investigation of who the people are behind this this violence in the camps. That cannot be a reason for a relocation to an island, particularly without the participation of the refugees and the assessment being done. We're not opposed to any relocation. Let's just be clear on that we're not opposing a relocation. It's Bangladesh has extended its generosity at hosting the refugees. I think what's more important here is to look at the participation process of the refugees, if they're comfortable relocating.
I do want to ask you about that. When you talk about the participation, the government has said that they are not forcing anyone to go to this island, but there are reports of people's names being added to lists without consent, people fleeing for fear of forcibly being relocated to these islands, hunger strikes, allegations of beatings. Is the government lying when it says it's not forcing anybody to go to this island?
So we've heard allegations. There have been circumstances where at least two refugees have said that their shelters were damaged and they wanted to have them fixed. But the camp authorities said they should consider relocating to the island instead. And their shelters were not fixed. So they felt that they relocated out of compulsion than a choice. So that's some of the experiences. There's one woman who spoke to Amnesty International saying that her husband has been on the island since May, and she didn't feel that he could come back to the camp. And with being a single parent with a son, she felt that it was difficult for her to stay in the camp for this long, and she thought that she'll go reunite with her husband instead. So in all these anecdotes that I'm sharing with you, it looks like some refugees were indeed forced in a way, or they felt compelled to go to the island instead of, I mean, this is not the standard definition of a voluntary decision that we understand.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit more specifically about the forced relocation to this island, because it seems the island itself, just the island, not even just the conditions, the island itself is dangerous. It's less than 2 meters above sea level. It's entirely made of silt. It just emerged from the sea 20 years ago. Bangladesh is already very vulnerable to cyclones, flooding, storm surges. So how can an island like this even be considered when it seems to just be a sitting duck, basically, for a cyclone?
So a cyclone has not directly hit the island. There have been a recent cyclone that took place, Cyclone Amphan, but that has gone past the island. It has hit in other places, not the island. There have been concerns with the embankment levels in the past that we've learned from previous short assessments that have been carried out by some agencies. But these data are not publicly accessible. I mean, for us as Amnesty International, we think that without going to the island, without knowing the facilities that there are, we've heard from the Bangladeshi authorities, we've heard from others as well, but it's all hearsay so far. The Bangladeshi authorities are saying that they have created this infrastructure, they've developed this infrastructure over the last 3 years. They've created embankments, they've created the accommodation over there. This is all good, but we don't know for certain about what safeguards there are with regards to their human rights. Where can they go if there is any allegation of the human rights violation? And what are their options to communicate with their family members in Cox's Bazar? The freedom of movement, the sustainable livelihood, their access to education, all that is, I mean, even if the Bangladesh authorities say that they're there, where is there's a lack of transparency. That's okay. Where I'm trying to get at. We've not had that opportunity to go for ourselves and see the facilities ourselves.
Now, to be fair to the Bangladeshi government, many have rightly criticized the international community for failure to put enough pressure on the de facto leader of Myanmar, of course that's Aung San Suu Kyi, to stop the genocide in the first place. How much of this crisis does fall on the shoulders of the international community?
I think to a large extent, because Bangladesh is a small country. It's a country of 160 million people, and that too with its own challenges, economic challenges, employment, literacy. Those challenges are there for Bangladesh as well. It's becoming a middle-income country. It is striving for that status. But until that happens, when you have this kind of responsibilities, the international community certainly has a role to play in supporting the refugees, in supporting Bangladesh with managing the refugees for as long as they are, and more importantly, I think, to expedite the process of creating conditions in Myanmar for the returns to happen in the safe, voluntary, and dignified conditions. It's not just about the justice and accountability mechanisms that's already going on that the ICC has taken up to investigate, and it's also going on in other international platforms as well. But having said that, I think the pressure needs to be put on Myanmar really to end the violence and come into the discussion with the victims, with the Rohingya community, and recognize that their rights have been violated, and those rights need to be guaranteed, just as any other people or any other people of any country.
And that will be the last word. Saad Hamadi with Amnesty International, thank you very much for joining us on Upfront. And that is our show for this week. Upfront will be back next week.